This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Repeat after me. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is not the economy, and the economy is not the Dow. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 5th of March. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. One could quibble, should one choose, about the close on the Dow today. It's not inflation adjusted, some will say. It is just 30 companies, after all. So as economic indicators go, the Dow has its problems. But it is worth a moment, 90 seconds perhaps, to consider what it does mean to put a 117-year-old market index into some modern-day context. Marketplace's Mark Garrison drew the short straw today.
Turn your gaze away from the skyward green arrow on Dow graphics, and you see a broader economy that's a rather mixed bag for ordinary Americans. Among the positives, rising home prices. On the negative end, a murky job picture and payroll tax hike.
Put it together and you have an economy that's still moving forward, but it certainly isn't booming, and the Dow would leave you feeling as if everything's booming.
Mesirow Financial Chief Economist Diane Swonk points out that much of the corporate profit fueling stock surges is not from strong sales, but budget cutting.
We don't want to see profits from cost-cutting alone. We want to see profits from improvements in the economy.
The stock markets are also up because the Fed has been flooding the economy with cheap money. When share prices go up, there's an idea in economics that people will spend more because they feel richer. That's called the wealth effect, something Wichita State economist William Miles specializes in.
There is an impact. There's no question about it. I think it tends to be concentrated on people in the upper income brackets because they're the ones that own the most stock.
So a rising Dow could open wealthy wallets a little wider. It's worth noting not all economists think the wealth effect has a major impact. One place where Dow milestones absolutely always have an impact, CNBC.
And historic day on Wall Street.
Nick Diogen is the network's editor-in-chief.
We're always preparing, and obviously the days you prepare for are usually the days it happens.
When it does happen, like today, he says, it gets the adrenaline flowing on set.
People know that they're playing on a big stage and they want to do the best job possible at moments when there are more people watching.
There's a lot the Dow doesn't tell us about the broader economy, but it does put on a good show. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Speaking of shows, let's see now. We've got ESPN. We've got the new-ish NBC Sports Network. We've got various and sundry teams that have their own cable channels. There is, in other words, no shortage of athletics on television, which of course means we are going to get more. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp announced today it's going to start up its own offering, Fox Sports One, it's going to be called. Whether it changes the sports programming landscape remains to be seen. Could well change your cable bill, though, as Marketplace's David Gura reports.
News Corporation is in movies, publishing, and of course, cable news, but it's still not satisfied. Mike McCann teaches sports law at the University of New Hampshire.
News Corp looks at sports and says, look, that's a market that we can exploit.
Sports is a pretty safe bet. We can TiVo sitcoms. We can watch a whole season of Homeland in one weekend. But the game? Well, sports economist David Barry says most of us want to watch it live.
You will sit there, and you will sit there through all the advertisements.
A sports network needs sports, and Gabe Feldman, who directs the sports law program at Tulane, says when it comes to broadcast rights, Fox is in pretty good shape, better shape than, say, NBC Sports. Fox already owns expensive rights to broadcast baseball, NASCAR, soccer, and football. And the next time a new TV contract comes up for renewal, Feldman says the bidding war will be even fiercer.
ESPN is in the middle of paying $1.9 billion a year for Monday Night Football. They now have another potential competitor there.
Cable providers pay more to carry ESPN than any other channel. And if broadcast rights go up, odds are your cable bill will too. Sports economist David Barry says News Corp has ambitious plans, and it recognizes something important. You can't just air games 24/7.
People also seem to like, and I don't quite understand this part, they do seem to like the whole sports discussion thing.
ESPN's got SportsCenter, Fox Sports 1. They'll have one of Notre Dame's biggest fans.
It's 1949. I'm there with Frank Leahy at the end of a four-year unbeaten run.
Regis Philbin will host Rush Hour, a sports talk show that'll air every day. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Regis. All right, this is S day plus four for those of you keeping score at home. But the problem with the sequester, and yes, there I said the word, the problem is that it's one of those things that it's going to creep up on us, the effects of it, that is. So we are going to start a new thing today, a sequester scorecard, if you will. And if you don't like that, you're welcome to suggest a better name. Anyway, here is today's installment of what the sequester is doing to us.
Thank you for calling the White House Visitor's Office 24-hour information line. Tours will proceed as originally scheduled through Friday, March 8th. Due to staffing reductions resulting from sequestration, we regret to inform that White House tours will be canceled effective Saturday, March 9th, 2013, until further notice. Unfortunately, we will not be able to reschedule affected tours. We very much regret having to take this action, particularly during the popular spring touring season.
What do you think? A little politics in there? Nah. Hey, so did you hear the Dow closed at a record high today? Sequester that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, died today at the age of 58. He'd been fighting cancer for nearly 2 years now. Chavez was known for many things: declaring a socialist revolution in Venezuela, railing against the United States with some degree of frequency. But the question his death raises is what happens to the Venezuelan economy and thus its oil as well. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on the sustainability desk. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
So this was, under President Chavez, a command economy, right? I mean, he was the guy.
He ran the place. And several people I talked to said the Chavez model goes to the grave with him. I mean, so much, as you say, of this Venezuela model was his. The socialist utopian model, the taking of corporate assets if he decided he wanted to, you know, moving the goalposts for foreign investors in the oil and other sectors. So now that he's gone, you know, one historian I talked to said there's no going back. He had so much power, so much charisma. I guess the test is going to be whether his successor can pull together the kind of political capital to be Chavez 2.0.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. The Vice President Maduro is the handpicked successor. Can't talk about Venezuela without talking about their oil. They are the fourth or fifth largest and have been for many years importer to the United States. But their volume now is at record lows, in part because we have so much shale oil and shale gas here now. Are we less worried about what happens in Venezuela, do you think, because of that?
Well, you know, as you say, the U.S. import dependency has gone down. We still import on the order of 8 million barrels of oil per day. So we actually still need a fair amount. Mm-hmm. But as you say, less of it is coming from Venezuela. But one of the big misperceptions in the oil markets is it matters a whole lot where we get it from. And in a global market, it actually doesn't matter too much. Hmm. It's a big pool if we think about it. So, you know, if we get less from Venezuela for whatever reason, you know, we would just get more of it from, say, Canada or another place. But having said that, yes, our dependency on Venezuelan oil has kind of gone down over time anyway, and we've actually exported more refined product to them. So, it's less of an uneven relationship than it was before.
What about American companies who used to, because there aren't many down there, used to do business down there? It was, I mean, you gave away a chunk of your business to the Venezuelan government in the person of Hugo Chavez if you decided to get involved down there, didn't you?
Well, right. In his time there, he took the royalties and he doubled them, and then he doubled them again. And then at a certain point, he said, you know, we're going to be the operators. We're going to do the drilling here. So the big international companies with all the technology and the toys, you can come, but you're just kind of financial investors. Hmm. And a lot of the companies decided, you know, that's that relative to the other places we could put our money, it's not worth it. So just a couple left there.
Marketplace's Scott Tong on the sustainability desk for us. President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela dead this afternoon at the age of 58. Scott, thanks a bunch.
Okay, you're welcome.
Coming up from our friends in the European Union, what sequester might bring to us.
One thing is the discredit of politics in general. The fact that it is the government, the state, that is affecting this austerity agenda has led many people to lose confidence in the government, in the state.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 125 points today, 0.9%, ended at a record 14,253. The NASDAQ gained 42 points, 1.3%, 3224 at the bell. The S&P 500 up 14 points, nearly 1%, 1539, the number you're looking for there. For the buy and hold crowd among you, Dow Component Bank of America added more than 1% today, finished at one-fifth of its price on the last record day, October of 2007. J.P. Morgan banked 0.75% today. That is 5% higher than 5 years ago. Among Dow Tech, IBM was up 0.6%, closed 74% above its price the last record day. Hewlett-Packard added 2%, more than double its price back then. Dow mainstay General Electric rose 1.3% today, still more than 40% below its price on that day in 2007. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.89%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Threats from space. That's the topic of a House Science, Space, and Technology Committee hearing, specifically tracking and mitigating asteroids and meteors. The committee is calling this part one, just like a sci-fi movie, but not. Stockpiling office supplies to get organized in case the world ends. Staples reports quarterly earnings. And the Federal Reserve releases its beige book, which summarizes current economic conditions. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so it's worth a little trip down memory lane as we put the close on the Dow today into some context. We had the housing market going bust, as you remember, back in 2006, 2007-ish. The financial crisis hot on its heels in 2008, the stock market tumbling all the while. The Federal Reserve says American families lost an average of 40% of their total wealth during the recession. So now that the economy is growing again and the stock market is back at its lofty highs, are we all back? Sally Herships has that story.
So if you've heard the news about the Dow, you may be thinking, have I made back the money I lost during the recession?
Well, it depends on what you did.
James Angel teaches finance at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business.
If you panicked and sold when the market went down, you probably bought high and sold low, so you're out of luck.
If, on the other hand, you viewed the dip in the market as a buying opportunity,
you're probably really happy today.
But before you get overly excited, listen to Jeremy Siegel. He teaches finance at Wharton.
Well, the Dow is not the whole market.
And Siegel says only a little over half of Americans own stock. According to a Gallup poll, that's considerably fewer than before the recession.
For the typical household, probably the value of their house matters more to their personal wealth than their stock holdings.
Matt Kafina is editor of Morningstar's newsletter, Stock Investor.
And even more important than that, I think, in terms of people's well-being is their income.
Kafina says, in general, household income has been stagnant for the last 5 years. Today's Dow reflects corporate profits growing much more quickly than household income.
Unless you're Mitt Romney, I don't think you're feeling all that wealthy right now or all that well off.
But good news for the 50% of Americans who do own stock can mean good news for the rest of the country, too. If investors feel better about their wealth, they are more likely to spend it. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
For all the talking there's been about the budget cuts the past couple of weeks or so, there are some things that probably haven't quite sunk in yet. One, what it's going to feel like once things really do kick in. And two, how long are we going to feel those things? What to do if only there were some countries that have experience with big budget cuts.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
All right, so they call it austerity over there, more severe, obviously, than what we're feeling. But we were thinking there may be some object lessons to be had. Miguel Ancho Morano is a journalist in Madrid, Spain. Louise Williams is in Dublin, Ireland. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
So, Louise, we'll start with you. It's been, what, 4 or 5 years now of austerity over there, huh?
Yes, grinding austerity. I know we're moving into springtime. I'm looking at daffodils on my desk. They're yellow. They should be reminding me of kind of a lift in the air. But you don't feel it here. You really don't. It's a paring back and a paring back and a paring back of public services. And there's this sense here that it'll never end. You know, there's a real gloom in the air in Dublin and things are grim.
Miguel, is it that way there? I mean, it's been 2 years or so of austerity budgeting in Spain. Are you feeling the slow squeeze?
Yes, exactly. It's 2 years, so we are not in the same situation as in Ireland. But yes, we are, of course, feeling very much the pinch of these austerity measures. The problem is, in the case of Spain, that it's not easy to isolate the effects of the austerity cuts, the spending cuts, from the tax raises which accompany them in the case of Spain. So they in a way, they mistake one thing for the other.
Yeah. It's safe to say I think we're not going to have too many tax raises over here if things keep going the way they're going. But what has surprised you, Miguel, about what happens in a country when there is austerity like this? I mean, what is happening that you didn't expect?
Well, one thing is the discredit of politics in general. The fact that it is the government, the state, that is affecting this austerity agenda has led many people to lose confidence in the government, in the state, which in Spain is something new.
Yeah. Louise, same question to you. What has happened in the past 5 years that nobody expected would happen?
Well, I can, for myself, I don't know if you can say you can be surprised by passivity. But I'm really surprised that we've been so passive in our response to these cuts.
So, Louise, if I told you that Americans now are in the very beginning stages of this, what advice would you have for us as we embrace, I suppose, austerity measures of a sort over here?
Certainly from our experience here in Ireland is that there tends to be quite radical cuts are announced. And then there's very intense lobbying takes place. And then what we shift into is a process of negotiation and deliberations. And then we get a kind of a gentle chopping away of services, of public services. It's a very different situation here to what you're going through in the US. Mm-hmm. But this shifting sands just makes it very, very difficult for us, even as a nation, to know what's next.
Miguel, have you been following the news of this sequester thing that we have going on over here?
Yes, I have. Well, I think it's peculiar to the American system. we don't have that autonomy in deciding our own economy because we are part of the European Union. And in Spain, well, even when the politicians of a country, the elected representatives, don't want something to happen, that happens anyway. That's quite a different sort of problem.
Miguel Ancho Morado in Madrid and Louise Williams in Dublin, Ireland. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
The National People's Congress convened in Beijing today. It's a rubber stamp session mostly to formally install Xi Jinping as the new president of China. He's got a whole lot of work ahead of him running the world's second biggest economy, not least of which is making sure economic discontent doesn't become a political problem. Over the past 20 years or so, more than 40 million people have had their land taken illegally, they say, by local governments. The land has been used for development, the government claims, to drive China's economic growth. But our China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports that is small solace.
In the middle of Shanghai, there's a secret neighborhood the size of a city block surrounded by a 10-foot wall. Inside is a field of weeds. Stray cats prowl through the charred corpses of old homes. It's a strange scene, particularly here in the middle of Shanghai's old French concession, which has some of the most expensive real estate in China. But for the past decade, this lot has sat here, undeveloped and oblivious to the most rapid economic boom in modern history going on all around it. But there are people here, and they're aware. Kang Chenggeng sneaks me past a police officer guarding the only entrance to this neighborhood to show me what's left of his home. A decade ago, this was a quiet alleyway neighborhood called Maggie Lane. Officials from the Shanghai district of Shuhui had plans to sell the land to a developer to build a luxury condominium complex. Maggie Lane residents say Shuhui officials tricked them into leaving their neighborhood. They told them their homes were of historical importance. The government would rebuild them, and afterwards, residents could move back. Shuhui government officials refused interview requests for Marketplace.
This is a human rights issue. This is a system issue.
Kang says as Maggie Lane's residents started to leave, they discovered officials had lied to them. The government changed the legal designation for the land, changed the resettlement terms, and suddenly they weren't able to return to their homes. If they wanted new housing elsewhere, they'd have to forfeit much of their resettlement compensation for it. Kang and a dozen others stayed put.
The demolition crew cut my water and gas, and they took my front door off the hinges. I wouldn't leave. Then they broke my windows and poured buckets of raw sewage into my home. I still didn't leave. Then, when it was raining hard, they used an excavator to smash my roof in. Everything got wet, so I left.
Kang's been homeless ever since. Sometimes he comes back here to check on his old home. He looks through the hole in the roof that's still there. Sunlight shines through it onto broken glass, piles of bricks, and splintered lumber. From the shattered window of Kang's old kitchen, you can see what's left of the home of Zhushui Kang and his wife Li Xingzhi. According to Chinese court documents, on the night of January 9, 2005, two employees of the developer set fire to the couple's home to try to get them to leave. Another neighbor, Chen Zhongdao, remembers that night.
The fire alarm went off, but we didn't go outside to see what was going on because we were scared of getting beat up by the developer's thugs.
Zhushui Kang was an elderly man who had fought and survived the Korean War as a Chinese soldier decades ago, but he was no match for the developer. He and his wife burned to death in their bed. Months later, two employees of the developer were given reprieve death sentences. Another got life in prison. And the Shuhui government built a wall around the neighborhood, letting it sit as unfinished business for future leaders to take care of.
I believe the new leadership will take some kind of a tougher stand against those illegal takings.
Li Ping is an attorney in Beijing for the property rights group Landesa. He says tackling illegal land seizures will be a priority for the incoming president, Xi Jinping. Li's confident China's new leaders are ready to increase compensation and give fair resettlement packages to people like the residents of Maggie Lane. He says local governments have taken land from 40 million people in China, and the pace hasn't slowed down. It's beginning to threaten social stability.
According to the current pace of land expropriation, they will add 3 million people every year. If the compensation were not adequate, you basically add 3 more million dissidents each and every year.
The challenge, says Li, will be to give local governments more legal options to make money. As it stands, local governments hand over most of their tax revenue to the central government, so taking land from residents and selling it to developers is an irresistible temptation.
So you're
Chen Zhongdao still lives inside his half-demolished home. He says every year or two, Shuhui officials send a demolition crew to try and force them off the land.
I've told the men in the crews that if they try to take me from my home, I'll strap a gas canister to myself and we'll all die together. I've told them, I'm 60 years old. You guys are only 40. You have your lives ahead of you. I'm not afraid to die.
So far, the Xuhui government hasn't tested Chen's threat. Instead, officials have allowed Chen and his neighbors to stay here, living in their partially demolished homes. Officials paid off the developer, losing money for the district, and then redesignated Meggie Lane as land for public use. Yet, a wall remains around it. A few weeks ago, the district sent a crew to install new gas lines for Chen and his neighbors. He doesn't know what to make of this, but he's optimistic that change is afoot. China's new leadership may help people like him. And maybe someday, his house will again feel like home. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmidt for Marketplace.
We've got a slideshow of some of the houses in Rob's piece, and you're going to want to see a satellite shot of Maggie Lane, that neighborhood in the middle of the richest part of Shanghai that got torn down. We've got that at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a moment of levity, courtesy of the Italian elections last week, in which Silvio Berlusconi came back from the political dead and the comedian Beppe Grillo became a legitimate political power over there. Anyway, a couple of days after that election, the leader of the German opposition said, "I am horrified. Those two clowns won the election," which prompted this response from the director of Germany's Circus Roncalli. "Being a clown," he said, "is an honorable, very difficult, sensitive, and artistic occupation." So there you go. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow Industrials added 125.9 tenths%. The record is 14,253. The NASDAQ up 42 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 up 14 points, nearly 1%. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Katie Long, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.